Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The biggest part of the healthcare debate is about controlling costs. The president has said as much himself. Today, whether what's on the table now can actually do that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is good to have you here on this Monday. It is the 12th of October today. For all the months of debate and endless negotiations, the real work of figuring out what a health care bill might eventually look like will start not long after 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. That's when the Senate Finance Committee is scheduled to vote on its reform plan. The three House proposals and two Senate versions will eventually be married up into one plan for the president to sign. It will probably expand insurance coverage and do some other things, but it might not actually do much to control health care costs. You want to do that, you have to change the way medicine is practiced, as Joel Rose explains.
For all the talk in Washington about reshaping our healthcare system from the ground up, some say the Senate Finance Committee's aims are relatively modest.
This is a rather historic effort to provide insurance to most Americans, but this is not an effort to do anything on cost containment.
Dana Goldman teaches health policy at the University of Southern California. If you really want to control spending, Goldman says, you have to stop paying doctors for the quantity of services they provide and reward them for using treatments that save money and lives.
And if the patient does well, then the hospital gets paid, the doctor gets paid. And if the patient doesn't do well, then they're going to have to bear the costs. And ultimately, that would have been a really valuable change.
There are some pilot and demonstration projects in the Senate finance bill that are supposed to lead to that kind of change. Goldman says they're little more than a, quote, fig leaf. But for others, they're better than nothing.
If you're going to change the delivery system to improve care and lower costs, you can't do it all at once.
Elliot Fisher teaches health policy at Dartmouth College. He says skeptical doctors and hospitals need to see that these innovative payment structures can be made to work on a small scale.
This bill provides the foundation that will let us all start to work together to make those changes that will slow the growth of healthcare spending.
In the meantime, experts say that none of the bills in Congress would do that. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
If you're a T-Mobile customer, specifically a user of its popular Sidekick cell phones, and that's almost a million people, the company's got some bad news for you. All those pictures and contact numbers and calendar dates, in fact, virtually all personal information from your phone that had been stored on a central computer operated by Microsoft, quote, almost certainly has been lost. A lot of companies have been promoting the benefits of what's called cloud computing. It lets you access your data from anywhere you happen to be. But as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains, it's not without its perils.
I first heard about cloud computing early this year. CNET's Declan McCullough described it to me as the next big idea behind everything from Facebook to TurboTax and Twitter.
This is much, much more common for folks, say, in high school and college now. The folks who are keeping data on their computer will be a dwindling bunch over time.
Unless they have second thoughts after what's happened to users of T-Mobile's Sidekick phones, their data was stored by a unit of Microsoft called, inauspiciously enough, Danger. Harry McCracken writes about technology trends at technologizer.com. He says this raises big questions about trusting your data to outsiders.
People have kind of assumed that great big companies with lots of resources and lots of IT knowledge would be better at protecting our data than we can be ourselves, and this is really the first significant example that I can think of just massive failure where people would have been better off backing up their own information.
Marketers of the data on a cloud concept were on the defensive today. Reuven Cohen is founder of Anomaly, a Toronto-based cloud computing firm. He says the T-Mobile Microsoft data loss could have been easily avoided.
When you're using somebody else's service, you'd expect that they would have some kind of backup of your data, especially something you're paying for.
Up to now, though, the industry hasn't offered many guarantees, so says analyst Michael Cote.
All of that fine print and shrink wrap that you read, the software and technology industry has been really good about never being responsible for anything terrible or any bad hair days you might have.
Cote says consumers may now come to expect such promises. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
If you can't beat them, ban them. That seems to be the motto of one low-income neighborhood here in Los Angeles. Last year, South L.A. put limits on the number of new fast food restaurants that could open up shop nearby. Now it's got convenience stores in its sights, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Standing outside of Sam's Market in South Los Angeles, Raymond Funes says he shops at this convenience store a lot more than the grocery store.
They're really close to the house. It's like candy and stuff, sodas, chips.
The Rand Corporation just published a study on this neighborhood. It found far fewer chain supermarkets here than in wealthier parts of L.A., and four times more convenience stores.
It's less that people live in food deserts now. It's more people live in food swamps.
Economist Roland Sturm wrote the study. He says junk food is the major reason obesity rates in South L.A. are so much higher than in wealthier areas.
If we believe that the food environment is a major cause of obesity, then the big differences we see are in small convenience stores.
The L.A. City Council is looking at limiting the number of these stores in South L.A. Jeff Leonard is with the National Association of Convenience Stores. He says they serve a crucial need.
Convenience stores are able to be in areas that you can't have a bigger store or where corporate may not want to have a store.
Leonard says low-income shoppers often don't have transportation. Jonathan Mendoza says that's why he buys his groceries at a corner store.
I guess the basics, like tortillas, beans, eggs. Yeah, I mean, when there's no nearest place, I mean, this is the spot we go to, so.
LA's not the only place casting a critical eye on calories. A study of Philadelphia school kids found most of them made daily trips to the corner store, and New York schools just banned the beloved bake sale. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street took aim at 10,000 today on the Dow. They didn't quite make it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today's Nobel Prize in Economics came in two parts. Eleanor Ostrom at Indiana University and Oliver Williamson from the University of California, Berkeley were recognized for their separate but related work in something called economic governance, how groups are organized and how decisions can be made outside the market. Professor Ostrom is a political scientist by training, but she calls herself a political economist. Earlier today, she explained her work and how groups manage common resources to our Morning Report colleagues.
We've studied how farmers organize irrigation systems, how inshore fishermen organize some fisheries, not all. And now we have a major study of forestry around the world where we're studying government forests and local managed forests and forests that are being depleted.
Oliver Williamson at Berkeley shares the prize for his study of companies and how and why economic decisions are sometimes better made in the boardroom than in the open market. Professor Williamson, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I imagine this is not a bad phone call to get at 3:30 in the morning if you have to get a phone call then.
No, it was received with great pleasure. I and my family were overjoyed.
Your work, Professor, looks at why some decisions happen in the market and some happen inside corporations. Is there a practical example you might give of when it might make sense to do one thing in the market and another thing perhaps inside a firm, inside a corporation?
A really crucial feature is what are the nature of the assets that are being used? Are they easily redeployable to other uses, or are they highly specialized to this particular use? If they're easily redeployable, markets are going to work well. If, however, the assets are highly specialized to this particular need, now you run the risk that I engage in this transaction in good faith, unanticipated consequences present themselves, I want to bail out, I leave you high and dry. That's a risk that the supplier here would be reluctant to undertake without a risk premium that reflects the added risk that's associated with it. As a buyer, do I want to pay that premium, or am I better off taking it out of the market, sacrificing competition, but nevertheless having common bottom line to look at rather than two separate firms looking at it from their own point of view.
Is there a lesson to be drawn from your work and how it applies to some of the big banks and the actions that they took, you know, some of the actions that they took out of the marketplace behind closed doors without people really knowing what was going on and that decision making?
I think that more attention to organization. So, yes, you'd tell the SEC, you'd tell the Fed that new forms of risk taking as they come along are something that you should get a deeper understanding at. And if there are lurking hazards, uncover them and work out what the public policy ramifications are.
So I understand, Professor, that parking there on the Berkeley campus is quite at a premium. But one of the benefits of this award is you get a special parking permit. Is that right? You win a Nobel, you get a parking space?
That's correct. That's the whole incentive program now, wrapped up in a...
Now, have you filled out the paperwork yet?
I haven't, and the chancellor is traveling today, so I'm not going to get this SEER mark for a day or two, maybe a week or two. Bureaucracy turns over in its own pace, and I can manage in between.
Oliver Williamson is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and also, as of this morning, a Nobel laureate in that field. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
When the U.S. is firing on all of its economic cylinders, American consumers buy 80% of everything Mexico exports. We're not buying as much of anything as we used to, so Mexico is feeling the economic pain right alongside us. One lifeline for that country, though, is remittances, money sent home by expatriates who prospered here in the United States. Remittances have fallen sharply this year, but they still account for billions of dollars being sent back home. Frank Contreras reports now from Mexico's western state of Michoacán.
A huge fiesta is underway in León Cárdenas. It's a town of about 500 people, so small it doesn't even appear on some maps. The main road here has finally been paved. And that's the cause of this big celebration. Federal, state, and local government officials have shown up for the photo opportunity. But the real star of this ribbon-cutting ceremony is Ruben Chavez, who left Michoacán in 1987, seeking a new life in the United States. Now he runs a successful landscaping company in Chicago.
Now I have a gardening business, and we provide maintenance and service for new construction projects.
Chavez is the president of a federation of nearly 40 migrant associations in the Midwest, Florida, and California. Those U.S.-based organizations pooled together $2,000 for the road paving. Then they convinced local, state, and federal government officials here in Mexico to each put up $2,000 as well. The new road has vastly improved the quality of life in the town. Resident Juan Calderon Franco says it would have never happened if the people here had waited for the government to do it.
It was a dirty road, so when it rained, we had a lot of mud here. It made it hard for families and children walking to school. They always had mud on their shoes. Thanks to the migrants, now things are much better here. Before, we didn't even have sidewalks.
For more than 15 years, Mexican migrants living in the United States have been helping to pay for thousands of small-scale infrastructure projects here, and the timing couldn't be better. Mexico is experiencing its worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Exports to the U.S. are falling. Hundreds of thousands of people are out of work, and rising drug violence in Michoacán is frightening away many foreign investors. But the migrants continue to invest here. They have deep personal ties with Mexican communities, and they have the dynamism to affect change, says analyst Andrew Seely.
You've got to figure that someone who picks up and moves hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles from their home and starts a new life is pretty entrepreneurial. This is an entrepreneurial community. It's a group of people who really are bringing what other generations of immigrants have brought before them, which is a desire to do something new and innovative.
The migrant dollars have kick-started projects like baseball fields, churches, and greenhouses, which provide jobs here. The U.S.-based associations say they're not so much interested in profit as prestige. And lately, they've acquired a lot of political capital, as once-reluctant Mexican politicians pay them attention. At a private breakfast in the state capital, Morelia, a federal senator has invited several migrant association leaders along to discuss, well, anything they'd like. And the governor of Michoacán recently said he hopes the migrants will continue to invest in the state so that future generations can find a better life without having to leave their country. In Michoacán, Mexico, I'm Frank Contreras for Marketplace.
Coming up, when words can mean more than a cure.
One of the biggest complaints that we get when a client first contacts us is, my doctor wouldn't speak with me, or I can't get any information from my doctor, or I don't understand what happened.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 20 points today, 0.2%, closed at 98.85. The NASDAQ was flat. It lost around 0.1%, finished at 21.39. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points, 0.4%, ended things at 10.76. The price of crude oil gushed to above $73 a barrel today. That helped energy stocks burn brightly. ExxonMobil and Chevron both gained around 1.25%. Ford Motors revved up 7% on news its European sales had seen a double-digit increase in September. Google clicked up 1.5% today, that based on an analyst upgrade. European markets did pretty well because of unexpected profit reports at Philips Electronics. New York shares of the European powerhouse were up 7.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 3.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. SunGard Availability Services operates 5 million square feet of secure data center space dedicated to keeping people and information connected. More information at sunguard.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to meet with the President of Spain at the White House. The American Bankers Association and the American Bar Association wrap up a three-day conference on money laundering. And a symposium on end-of-life advocacy begins at the National Press Club. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The 2010 census will officially record that more than 300 million people live in this country. It's a diverse group, as we've known for a while now. But a study commissioned by the trade magazine Advertising Age says that diversity will pose some problems for marketers in the second decade of this century. We have now become so diverse that there is no such thing as an average American anymore. Peter Francis is a demographer at the advertising firm Ogilvy & Mather. He helped write the report that is out today. Mr. Francis, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Tell me what you have found as we start thinking about the 2010 census.
Well, the 2010 census is going to show that we are a truly multicultural and very complex society. Our two largest states, California and Texas, no single ethnic or racial group is a majority. The second thing we can talk about is the fact that we are a much more multi-generational household. So when it comes to major purchases like automobiles or homes or tuition to college, the decision is often made by two generations of people. It's the parents and the grandparents. There will be, in 2010, a record 70 million grandparents in America. And those grandparents are deeply involved with their grandchildren and financially involved.
The way I read your white paper, your analysis of this, there is no such thing as the average American consumer anymore.
Absolutely not.
So what the heck happened to them?
What happened to them is they fractionated, they fragmented into these small groups, and they became quite isolated. The internet has enabled people with very specific interests, whether it be in Hummel figures or whether it be NPR enthusiasts. There is a website that will reinforce those interests. And so the American public long ago exited any concept of a mass market, and it is now a collection of very small markets. Most times they want to see images that are directed right at them, and they want products crafted for them.
How might this reflect itself in what consumers see out there in terms of the way companies are trying to get us to spend our money?
You're going to see more advertising that reflects, first of all, the multicultural nature of the nation. You're going to see more advertising targeted to specific market segments. And you're going to see a lot more advertising that involves parents, grandparents, and children together.
That's just what I need, right? Now my kids are pressuring me, and you're telling me my parents are getting on me to buy stuff?
Your parents are going to say, Kai, you don't really make enough money. And, you know, our grandchildren, I mean, their clothes are so shabby, Kai. Let us take them out and buy them some clothes, right?
Have you been talking to my mother?
Exactly. You see, well, there's 70 million of your mothers out there, and they are all looking at their grandchildren and saying the same things. Their parents don't make enough money to buy the clothes that those kids deserve. They're not going to schools that are good enough for them, and they're going to foot the bill.
Peter Francis, he's the chief demographic analyst at the advertising firm Ogilvy and Mather. You can find a link to his white paper about the 2010 census that's coming up on our website. It's marketplace.org. Mr. Francis, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Malpractice hasn't gotten as much attention in the healthcare debate as, say, whether or not there should be a public option. But you turn the conversation to controlling costs, and eventually somebody will bring up the topic of how much extra money is being spent every year because doctors and hospitals are trying to avoid being sued. Those extra tests and possibly unnecessary procedures come out of consumers' pockets as they pick up the costs through higher insurance premiums. A healthcare overhaul may or may not do something to change that, but Tamara Keith reports some hospitals and doctors are trying a new approach to malpractice that very well might, an approach that involves just two little words.
The lobby of Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore is plastered with blown-up covers from U.S. News and World Report's Best Hospitals issue. Hopkins has been featured in it year after year. But even here, doctors and nurses sometimes make mistakes.
As many safeguards as we put in place, things do happen.
Meg Garrett is the director of risk management at Hopkins. She encourages doctors to say something patients rarely hear. It goes like this.
You know, I'm really sorry that this happened to you today, and we're going to investigate it. And then it's our policy that once it's been investigated, that we clearly know what either went wrong or what the complication is, that we have a disclosure to the family.
Where they sit down and talk about what happened. That kind of conversation, especially the apology, is downright revolutionary. Lawyers for insurance companies and hospitals are so afraid of lawsuits that doctors are often forbidden from talking to patients when something goes wrong. It's all about deny and defend. Andy Slutkin, a Baltimore malpractice lawyer, says that can be counterproductive.
One of the biggest complaints that we get when a client first contacts us is my doctor wouldn't speak with me, or I can't get any information from my doctor, or I don't understand what happened.
And often they're angry. Angry enough to sue. Slutkin regularly works on cases involving Johns Hopkins.
When there's open dialogue between the patient and the doctor, there's less of a likelihood of that patient coming to a lawyer to find out answers.
But you're a lawyer. Why are you promoting this?
Well, if I were a patient, I'd want my healthcare provider to communicate with me and tell me what happened and not avoid me.
Sometimes, he says, all it takes to keep a case out of court is an apology. That was true for Jennifer Wagner.
What that apology meant to me was that they had listened finally.
This comes from an educational video for doctors created by the University of Michigan Health System. The video is part of a malpractice settlement with Wagner. Her doctors missed a breast cancer diagnosis. 2 years later, when it was finally discovered, the cancer had spread, and she filed suit. The case was ultimately settled out of court, worked out in a meeting with hospital lawyers, Wagner, her lawyer, and her doctors.
I can't even describe how euphoric I felt when I left that meeting. All of these people had finally listened to me, and I had stood up for myself.
Wagner, who is cancer-free, also received a cash settlement of about $400,000. But it was far less than what hospital system lawyers feared she might get in court. Richard Boothman is the system's chief risk officer.
Let's just cut through the baloney, and we should just step up and take care of those cases where a true medical mistake was created.
Since Boothman took over in 2002, the University of Michigan Health System has been able to cut its malpractice insurance cash reserves to $13 million, from more than $70 million. Some critics believe that apologizing may be better for the doctor than it is for the patient. Mark Cohen is a malpractice lawyer. He says a doctor at Johns Hopkins tried to apologize to his family after his daughter Brianna died.
We were all devastated. The last thing we needed was an apology from the folks that created this terrible tragedy.
Cohen thinks in many cases, apologies aren't really about making patients and their families feel better.
I truly believe that the apology is an effort to make victims of malpractice go away.
But in some cases, I'm sorry is all they were ever after. I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, a quick follow-up on my Nobel Prize prognostication of last week. First of all, it is properly the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, since it wasn't in the original establishment of the award. But more to the point, the odds makers. Oliver Williamson was a 50-to-1 long shot. Eleanor Ostrom wasn't even on the list of possibles that was being bandied about last week. Either way, they both still get the gold medal and half the $1.4 million prize. Also, the parking space for Professor Williamson. Don't forget that part. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 20 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 0.1%, essentially flat. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, 0.3%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the program, in South Africa, punishing companies with ties to apartheid.
We are confident that we will be able to lay a very strong precedent for global accountability of business.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.